And she did come, and told me a long story about having seen a picture of a young Indian yogi in the newspaper, having looked for him all over town without success, until by a very remarkable coincidence she had discovered that the Indian she was seeking in vain all over the city with more than a million inhabitants, was living in another part of the very same building she was lodged in herself. It was a huge, modern block of flats, so it was no wonder the tenants didn't all know each other. After listening to her patiently for a while, I tried to cut her long, long story short, "And now, what do you want of me?" "You just must meet him," she said. "Let me bring him here and introduce him to you. He never goes out, preferring to live a very retiring life. But when I told him about your weekly lectures on yoga philosophy, he immediately expressed his willingness to come and see you. Look at some of these photographs of him." With only casual interest I took the photographs she held out to me, glanced at them, and caught my breath, "Bugger!" With my heart beating excitedly, I looked at all the pictures. Not the faintest doubt. I recognized the look of these big black eyes. The unbelievable purity and the childlike expression of the entire face, it was he. But he wasn't a little boy anymore, as I had known him and carried the remembrance of him deep in my soul. Now he was a grown-up young man. "Helen," I said to my friend, "tomorrow evening I have time. You may bring him." The next day Helen came with Bugar. We drank tea and chatted about all kinds of things, but all the time we did so my inward eye was seeing pictures of a great palace made with huge stone blocks, with a room in it, my room, with magnificent furniture inlaid with gold, a low couch covered with beautiful skins of animals, and on these skins a human form sitting, with legs, arms, hands and shoulders I can see, only the head I don't see because I am this human form, sitting on the animal's skins, and at my feet a child, a sweet vivacious child who now looks at me with the eyes of this young man from India. "And why does he call me queen?" I ask him. "Because you are a queen," he replies with conviction. "Yes. You're right. My husband says. She certainly can give orders, especially to me." With that he laughs heartily, and we all join in. My son enters, sees the Indian guest and stands stiff and rigid out of sheer surprise. Then he pulls himself together and I introduce him. Both he and Bogard look at each other long and searchingly. I succeed in bridging over the momentary embarrassment by offering my son a cup of tea. He sits down and joins us but is quite unable to take his eyes off the young Indian. That's how Bogar first came to us. In a very short time he had captured the hearts of everyone in the family. My parents and my brother and sister took him in as if he were a new brother among us. He opened his yoga school and since he didn't know our language, he asked me to give a weekly lecture on yoga for his pupils. Thus we began our work together. The war dragged on. In the winter we all went on with our work as we had before. And in the summer we moved into our little house in the forest. Bogar came with us, living in the forest according to the laws of yoga he had learned from his master. My son, by this time, had one plane crash behind him. Miraculously he had survived it with only a concussion of the brain. In due time he was well again with only a scar on his high good-looking forehead to remind him of his mishap. One hot summer day, when the great steamroller from the east was already near our borders, my dear, wonderful mother suddenly fell to the floor. When we tried to help her up again, she said very clearly, "Stroke, it's a stroke." Then she lay in bed for a long time, struggling painfully to bring forth one word after another as she told us she felt one side of her body was already dead. "And do you know," she added, "it's so interesting to be half here and half on the other side already. I still see each of you half from the outside and half as if from within. And I can also see your future destiny. As soon as I'm better, I'll tell you all about it. Right now it's very difficult to talk." She was already living very close to the world of the spirit. Whenever any one of her friends, at home in some part of the city, spoke about her, she would say to us, "Now my friend Mrs. X is here with me, and this is what she's saying." and Mother would tell us exactly, word for word, what her friend was saying in the same moment several miles away, as could later be proved in minute detail. And it also often happened that Mother was sitting in her flat talking to her nurse and I was up on the second floor talking about her with my husband. Then she would say to her nurse, "My daughter Esther is now here and this is what she's saying about me." And she would repeat word for word what I was saying about her in another part of the house and well out of her hearing. One day her nurse called me to come immediately. Mother had suffered a second stroke. I rushed downstairs. Mother lay there, still and pale as death, unable to say a thing. With her right hand she pointed at her tongue, giving me to understand she couldn't move it anymore. She lay there thus for several hours, without being able to speak. Suddenly the door opened and Boga came in. With her poor, twisted, half-paralyzed face, Mother looked at Boga, her eyes beaming with joy. Boga sat down beside her and enclosed her wrist in his hand. After a couple of minutes Mother opened her mouth and said very slowly, syllable by syllable, but quite clearly, "From Bogar's hand a force is flowing into me, and this force has now reached the part of my head where I feel pressure that prevents me from speaking. Thanks to this force that's flowing into me from Bogar's hand, the pressure has abated and I can talk again." Then she went on to tell us a number of important things, all part of her last wish. Boga went away after a while, and for an hour and a half Mother was still able to talk. Then all at once she said, "Now the force our dear Boga caused to flow into me is ebbing away. It's getting harder and harder to talk and use my tongue. The connection between me and my body is dissolving. God be with us." These were her last words. And 2 days later her coffin was carried out of the house. Her place at the head of our family table was empty. From then on we marked it with a burning candle when we gathered round. 45. The challenges are repeated. It was the last winter before the end of the war. Our gardener who had taken care of our orchard had long since been called up for military service. The orchard was forsaken, and I moved into our little forest house to save whatever I could. One night I was awakened by a horrible noise. Sirens. In the city. I jumped out of bed. From the dining room I could see the city in the distance. Dozens and dozens of airplanes roared over my head in the darkness. The air trembled with the noise of their engines. Suddenly a hellish drama began to be enacted in the air over the city as row after row of airplanes dropped their bombs into the masses of humanity living below. The sky came alight with the bursting of bombs and the fires they started throughout the city. The noise became deafening as, added to the roar of the engines and the bursting of bombs, the city's anti-aircraft cannon began picking out targets overhead as best they could. Seen from the distance, their fire looked like tiny red lanterns climbing up into the sky. From time to time I could see what looked like a huge burning torch plunging downward. And I knew that somewhere a mother would be waiting in vain for her son to come home. This breathtaking show of fireworks continued for about an hour and a half. It seemed to me I had been standing at my window for an eternity of time. Down there in front of me, where this interplay of lightning and thunder meant death and destruction for thousands of people, all my dear ones were living. All except my son, who at that very moment could perhaps be flying through the air as a target for other poor young men flying in much better aircraft, forced to shoot at him against all their human instincts, just as he was being forced to shoot at them. All at once I felt a force from a nearby tree calling for my attention. Looking towards the tree, I saw two green eyes staring at me. An owl. It sat there as immovable as a statue. Never before had I seen an owl in this whole area. How did it come here? Almost unconsciously I spoke to it in spirit, "You dear bird, it's not your fault that superstitious people think of you as a harbinger of death. Still, do you perhaps want to tell me that all my dear ones down there in the city are no longer living on this earth?" Immediately the owl danced a bit closer to me on the branch, suddenly spread his wings and flew off into the forest. Instantly I knew that a great power which controls and guides everything was telling me, through the disappearance of the death bird, that all my dear ones were still alive. Yes, all my dear ones. But all the thousands of people who were killed that night in the city, and all the others who have been killed during this terrible war, each such person was somebody's dear one. Why have these people had to die? Why do people kill each other senselessly? The hellish drama was repeated night after night. In the summertime, several of us moved into our little house in the forest. Bogar came with us. During the nights of terror, we all stood together at the window, watching the bombardment of the city below. Shortly after the sirens gave the all-clear signal, my husband would telephone with the reassuring news that he and the others with him in our city house were all safe and sound. When autumn came, I stayed behind alone in our forest house, continuing my work in the orchard and garden. Each evening I was able to observe how much closer to us the enemy artillery, oh, these poor young men who are forced into being our enemies, had moved up during the course of the day. One evening I decided I was going back to the city. Come what might, I was determined to go through at the side of my loved ones the difficult hours of siege and bombardment that lay ahead. Then my telephone rang. How strange! I suddenly felt positive I had already experienced this same situation some time before. I knew in advance that my husband was just now going to call me, and I knew word for word what we were going to say to each other. And all the while I felt as if I were dreaming. And this same strange feeling was to continue throughout all the difficult days to come, until the days turned into weeks, the weeks into months and the months into years. Again and again I found I knew exactly what was going to happen. The next moment, just as if I had already experienced all these terrible things. Everything was simply repeated, I knew it! But I couldn't understand where and how I could have experienced these situations before. After I had returned to the city and the sirens howling in the night forced me to join all the others in the house in a pell-mell flight into the cellar, and as we sat there, all of us calm, passive, earnest and worried about what was going to happen next, all the while I knew that somehow, somewhere I had experienced all this before. And so it was to be with me throughout all the nights, the horrible nights of bombardments and air raids. I experienced this feeling of reliving past events even more strongly one day in late autumn when the door opened and my son came in. Why was I surprised to see him in an Air Force uniform? Yes. I still remembered him as Ima, the young priest in Egypt, and I also knew all the relationships that linked us together. But in my memory of him in Egypt he wore quite different clothing. How do I come to feel that even in my life in Egypt I already saw him in this Air Force uniform? Why do I have the feeling that everything I experience is not reality, that I'm merely dreaming all these pictures, and that I'm experiencing these dreams in my initiation sleep in the Great Pyramid? I clearly remember all the relationships of my life in Egypt, but no matter how hard I try, I cannot remember the events nor my initiation dreams. How strange! How can one remember that one doesn't remember? If I can't remember something, then I cannot know that it has existed. But I know I experienced my whole future destiny in visions during my initiation in the pyramid, and that these visions, or dream pictures, were the occasion for my passing various tests and meeting certain challenges. It's true my master Tahotep warned me that if I were to fall after my initiation, all the tests I had to go through during my initiation would be repeated on the earthly plane. Yes. Continually I have the certain feeling that these events are repeating themselves. For a number of years I made a habit of writing down every morning, as I was waking up, the dreams I had had during the night. I had not reviewed these records for a whole year. Now I began to read them. And to my great surprise I found that most of these dreams I had recorded were dreams I had of events to come, events which I actually experienced later, sometimes as much as 6 months or a year later. In the meantime I had completely forgotten the dreams themselves, and if I had not been able to see and recognize my own handwriting, I would not have believed that I had dreamed these dreams and recorded them. How was it possible that when these things actually happened I couldn't remember any more that I dreamt them in advance, and in many cases even in amazingly accurate detail? I found this discovery to be literally amazing. What kind of a force is there within us that knows our future in advance with such precision and tells us about it beforehand? And what kind of imperfect creatures are we who understand so little about the language of dreams that we can't remember having dreamed in advance about a certain event or situation, even when the dream is repeating itself on the earthly plane in our outward life? Truly, we don't deserve the care and attention this force bestows upon us as, with infinite patience, it reveals new truth and knowledge to us. How could I explain remembering from an earlier life in Egypt that I had seen my son in an Air Force uniform and that when he came in I knew exactly he was going to take leave of me because his unit was going to be transferred to an airfield less exposed to enemy bombing than the one near our city? As he spoke and as I answered, I knew within me that I had experienced all this once before. Again I had the feeling I was only dreaming. I didn't dare tell anyone of this experience. I was afraid that even my son, Ima himself, would believe my mind had suffered from all the excitement. It seemed much better to keep silent about the whole matter. And so we lived through the siege of our city. For 7 weeks we sat in our cellar, enduring incessant bombings. After the house above us had been bombed and shelled into a heap of rubble, we were forced to flee. Our destiny tossed us about like a leaf in the wind, and after many trials and tribulations we began to rebuild our lives. We were all reduced to the state of beggars. My husband had been seriously injured, and it was a long time before he could work again. By dint of days and nights of effort with no more equipment than primitive man had in the first primeval jungle, Boga and I fashioned a new home out of the ruins of our family house, and in it we reopened our yoga school. Months went by as we worked hard and long. Those were times when we learned what hunger is. Week by week we gradually wasted away, shrinking from human beings of flesh and blood to living skeletons covered with skin. Even good friends would fail to recognize each other when they met by chance on the street. Fear, a baleful new fear, spread throughout the population, augmenting the feelings of fright already present in thousands of tortured souls. What will we eat tomorrow? How long will we be able to go on working so hard without even once getting enough to eat? How long can we go on like this and still maintain our health? Our country's fertile soil had brought forth plenty of everything we needed, but we were forced to look on while countless freight trains snaked their way through the countryside, carrying off our rich harvest to another country. Then after long and difficult months, even the famine began to abate. More and more frequently we got something nourishing to eat, and gradually we began to put on weight. Once again, good friends and acquaintances failed to recognize each other on the street. We had all got accustomed to seeing each other so thin and emaciated, and every so often in passing someone on the street, the thought would flash across our mind that this well-fed person bore a striking resemblance to some very thin friend. Both of us would have the same thought, then turn around, recognize each other, and break out in peals of laughter at the happy reunion. But months went by before we became really reacquainted with all our friends, reaccustomed to their normal dimensions. I still had the feeling that I had already experienced all of this. It was a feeling that stayed with me wherever I went and whatever I did. It was not that I could foretell the future. On the contrary, it was merely the persistent feeling that everything had already happened just that same way once before. And not being able to foresee the future, I did not know what had become of my son. Since the time he suddenly took leave of us, he had not been heard of. A year and a half later, our doorbell rang. I opened the door, and who should I see before me but my son? And once again I had that strange feeling known by psychologists as the déjà vu. I knew it was a repetition. All these events were repetitions. But how could that be? And one night everything became clear. Once when I was forced to pass the test of cruel love towards the person I love most dearly here on earth, my son, I kneeled in my bed in the dark of the night and talked about him with God, asking him to show my son the way he should go, I followed the pathway which, within us, leads to God, withdrawing my consciousness from my outer person into my inner being. Finally, I fell into a trance and suddenly found myself in front of the seven steps I have told about earlier. And I jump up, from one to the next, easily, happily, and joyously. I know the way. I remember. Oh God! I remember. All these events I've been experiencing as reality in my life on the material, earthly plane are things I experienced several thousand years ago in my initiation in the pyramid. At that time, all these events were lying in the depths of my soul as unconscious, still latent energies, still pure cause. This is because everything that happens here on earth is the materialization of a complete, accomplished cause waiting on the spiritual plane for materialization. When one achieves the ability consciously to reach the depths of the self where those energies are awaiting their realization, one experiences cause simultaneously with the effect, the future, as a complete and perfect present. And the present, our life, everything that happens to us is merely an opportunity to meet the tests and trials and challenges of initiation. An opportunity to relax the tensions and dissolve away the stresses we have stored up within ourselves, for eons and eons of time, by our thoughts and words and deeds. The tensions and stresses that are the cause of our destiny, our future. To the extent that we are able to become conscious of these tensions and overcome them, we free our human consciousness which is tied down by these energies and limited because it is tied down, and we identify our consciousness with the true divine self waiting behind every personal feeling of ego. We identify ourselves with God. And that is initiation. Conclusion. After the experience of that night, I knew the tensions and stresses had been erased from my soul. Everything personal would have to be discarded. I had overcome myself. There was nothing more within me to bind me to my person. Everything personal had to disappear. It began with a very strange feeling which followed me wherever I went, at home or outdoors, that I wasn't really there. Not there, but where. I really didn't know. But I suddenly became aware of the fact that myself was never where my person, my body, was located. On the contrary, myself projected itself out of spacelessness into my person, and now myself was beginning to project itself somewhere else than where my physical being was. But where? Into another country. I knew I was going to go away, that I was going to have to go away. Whenever the spirit, the cause, ceases to be present, the appearance, the effect, must follow it wherever it is projected by the cause. There it can go on living. Otherwise, the appearance would disappear, that is, die. But how am I supposed to leave this country? No one can get a passport. The time for my departure had not yet come. Other events had to take place first. One night I awakened quite suddenly. I saw my father standing before me, taking leave of me with a smile on his dear sweet face. I understood, it was time for him to go. I wanted to jump up and ask him why he wanted to go away and where he was going, but he disappeared, and I realized that I was just awakening. Father was 80 years old, but hale and hearty in body and mind. With ever fresh and undiminished energy, he was still going on with his very responsible government job. Nevertheless, I knew his spirit had come to me to take leave. His time had run out on the great cosmic clock, and he was going to leave his body behind. The next day he was already in the hospital, and all the rest of us gathered round to say goodbye. He either could not or would not speak. With long, deep and tender glances he looked each of us in the eye in turn. Then he closed his eyes and didn't open them anymore. And we accompanied the second coffin out of our family. My son tried everything he could to get work. In vain. He kept on trying, again and again, but always in vain. Finally, he came to the realization that there was no room for him anymore in our country. And the day came when he took his guitar, a dear old traveling companion he had never neglected even in the grimmest days of the war, and went away in search of a country where a free man who wanted to work could find a home. Again we took leave of each other, not knowing whether we would meet again in this life. But in the depths of myself I knew I would see him again. I knew we would still be working together in God's garden. Then came the last act. Bogar had just given a public lecture. As usual, the audience was so big the police had to keep order. After the lecture, he found himself surrounded by people plying him with questions, begging for autographs, and refusing to let him go home. While all this was going on, my husband and I were standing a bit apart from the crowd, waiting. Suddenly, an officer of the secret police appeared and asked to speak with me. When we had stepped to one side, he said, "I practice yoga, and my whole family with me, so I know it's a wonderful system. Nevertheless, both you and the Indian are dangerous, because so many people listen to you and do as you say. The Padri doesn't like that. So now you're going to have to decide either to work with the party and for it, or to get out of the country. We'll let you both go without hindrance. But if you refuse to go, we'll be forced to take other measures. Think over this proposition my superiors have asked me to bring you, and act accordingly. I'll come back to hear your decision." Bogar could have left the country freely with his passport. But I was obliged to seek permission and apply for an entry permit to another country. Soon I was involved in an endless chase for an exit permit and for entry permits. Finally, I was forced to realize that it was an absolute impossibility for me to get a passport. I was shunted back and forth from one office to another until at long last I received a final and definite refusal. But that meant the secret police would soon be having recourse to other methods. And we all knew what that meant. Many of our friends had already disappeared for good and all, while others, after suffering horrible tortures in prison, had been released, broken in mind and body, only to die miserable deaths shortly thereafter. Then Bogar said to my husband, "The only possibility of saving your wife is for you to divorce her and let me take her out of the country as my wife. In this way she'll have the same passport as mine, and we can leave the country legally. And you'll come later." My husband seized Bogar's hand but was unable to say a word. Big tears of gratitude welled up in his tortured eyes. So the day came when I took leave of all the people near and dear to me, and set out into the unknown world, to make my home wherever God should lead us. Bogar kept his word. He came from the other end of the world to save me. We found Emma again, and together we are traveling on in the footsteps of the Titans who have shown us the pathway to initiation, to redemption, to the lost paradise. And when I seek those whom I love, I turn the searchlight of my consciousness inward, for everything and everyone is living within me. The self, at one and the same time the self of all living creatures, and therefore myself, knows no bounds, so the entire universe is within me, and myself fills all the universe. Everything that is, I am. In everything I love myself, for the only things we think we don't love are what we haven't yet come to recognize within ourselves. The self is life and the only reality, and whoever is initiated into the self, and in this way has come to know himself completely, loves everything and everyone equally, for he is one with them.